And now for our featured speaker today, Reverend Gregory Wilson, will speak on an age-old question that I'm sure we all have in our minds, to be or not to be a zombie.
I don't know what got into me when I made that up, or what got out of me. To be or not to be is not just a question, but it becomes a way of life. When Hamlet's world was crashing about him, what he held dear, what he knew to be true, was crumbling. The death of his father, his mother marrying his uncle, coming to the conclusion of the possibility that his uncle had his father killed, was too much for him to bear. His world was crashing down upon him, and he faced the question, to be or not to be, to be, to become, to continue to be creative, to continue to breathe, not to be, to ponder suicide. How many of us have found ourselves in that place where our world collapsed, and we too pondered that question, to be or not to be? We too thought it might be easier to let this life go rather than to continue on. Once you face that question about your own life, whether it is worth continuing or not, or once you face that experience that life is just too painful and you seriously ponder taking your own life, and you make the decision not to, something very important happens at that moment in time. We either begin to recreate ourselves, fight for our lives, or we numb ourselves and we walk and we live and we contribute and we go to work and we get up in the morning, but we're not really alive. And thus, to be or not to be a zombie. Last week in the sermon that I preached, I listened to a recording of it, and I'm glad you all returned after listening to that recording. Not because it was necessarily horrible or aggressive or that, but because it was very, I think, thick, and it had a lot in it. And I was clicking through the television, and I came across a preacher, a fellow by the name of Joel Osteen. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but it catches my attention when I go on the television and I see somebody preaching. And rather ordinary, not like John Hagee or Ron Parsley. And he had 18,000 people listening to him. So I thought I should take note and pay attention to that. And a couple of things stuck to my mind after, struck me after listening to him. One, the thing that I remember was that if I'm in a shopping center parking lot and I come to another car and we're looking at the same parking lot, that I should give way and allow this other person to take my parking lot. And that would prove and that would justify my faith and love and understanding. Okay. Another thing that struck me was that he said that it was important to get to work on time. It was important to be nice to the people that you work with, and important to be nice to your neighbors. And I sat back and I thought, last week I talked about transnational capitalist class, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights, and I wondered if I was missing something. Then I thought, no. When you look at our seven principles, you don't see in our seven principles absolute truths. What you see in our seven principles is a way of life. It is the process of life. It is a process that asks questions. We want to understand why. We want to know what we're contributing to. We want to know what our life energy goes to. Is it a worthwhile effort? We're searching for truth and meaning, and an honest search for truth and meaning. We're searching for some sense of justice. And for about 6 months now, we've been pondering, where does justice come from? Where does that concept of justice even come from? And we've been working with that. And we traveled 50,000 years into human history to try to understand the origins of justice. Life is more than allowing somebody else to take a parking lot, parking space. I'm going, well, yes to that, of course to that. But I'm wondering why there's this department store that has run all the little businesses out of our community, and we're looking at a store that doesn't pay living wages rather than figuring out how to park on the parking lot. And I think that's what a Unitarian Universalist is. We ask those questions. And I'm not saying that's good or bad, but what I am saying is we ask those questions. Then I got to thinking further. Last week I mentioned zombies, and that's why I threw that in the title. Not just to be funny, because I know when I watch movies, and I suspect that you have watched movies as well where there are zombies, and often we laugh when I see the zombies. But then I started to say, well, wait a minute, how can I really understand that, what zombie means? And so I put myself in the person being attacked by the zombies. And it is quite frightful to be that person being attacked. And then I put myself in the position of the zombie, and it was really nothing. There was a mindlessness to it. I didn't think, I just did. And then I got to thinking, what happens to somebody's mind when we use that word zombie and what that describes, and the genre, the form and the category of the movie of zombies was written by the author, at least one of the authors in the 1950s, as a social commentary, as an expression that we are becoming so conformed in our culture, we've given up thinking. We're just conformed. And I thought, well, what's going on with that? Because the major religions that I understand, including Unitarian Universalist, including Christianity, including Buddhism, including the teachings from the Apostle Paul, including the teachings from Jesus, all these religions have one thing in common. Protect your mind. When you look at the teachings of Jesus, what do you find when you look at the teachings? He says, be careful of false teachers. Be careful of wolves dressed in sheep's clothing. What do you say when you read the Apostle Paul? Be careful of false prophets. Be careful of false teachers. Be not conformed to this world. When you look at the story of Buddha, when he realized that he was going to become king because he was the son of the king and was being groomed for the king, he said, what I want to do in my life and how I would want to operate and the values that I would want to put into my society, I can't do as king. I would have to conform to the economic system, to the generals, to the politicians, and I would have to conform, and I wouldn't be able to do. So to protect his mind and to elevate and to work with his mind, he left the kingdom and went into a forest and became a monk and consequently became a founder of a religion. When we look at the words of William Ellery Channing, he said, guard your mind jealously. Protect your mind. We just recently talked about Margaret Fuller, who talked about gender and scripted behavior. Anne Chaif Wilson, who wrote a book called When Society Becomes an Addict. She says, we are in the world, but we are not to be of the world. And whenever you hear people in a recovery movement or whatever you look at the foundation of religions, there's a core, something that is core and central to all of them. And so the core is protect your mind. Protected. One reason we have the book club is we read books that are up to date. We read books that talk about our society. One reason I do that is so that we can protect our mind. The next book we're going to read for next month is called How Would Jesus Vote? And there's a war going on. And there's a war going on because you had the religious right, and religious right was part of a political movement that put people in the Supreme Court and that moved for one particular party. And now that particular fraction of people is breaking up. A guy named Jim Wallace, who's more evangelical than he is fundamental, says we need to be paying attention to the environment, to poverty, and that needs to be as important, if not more important, than issues of homosexuality and abortion, pro-life, pro-choice. And so now that's beginning to break up. And now there are two authors out there now. One is Tony Perkins, and the other is, I forget his name, he wrote also with John Kennedy, and that's the book we're going to read, How Would Jesus Vote? This is their first volley back at the Jim Wallace group that said there's a religious war going on, and it has importance. So we're going to stay up with that, and we're going to try to understand that, because in order to protect our minds, we need to know what's going on in the here and now. What would a zombie look like today? We think of the horror monster kind of pictures. And I went back a bit in history to try to understand that, because if I can get some understanding of what that might be, I might have some better understanding of how to protect myself. We know from several psychologists who wrote 30s and 40s and 50s and today, for example, Otto Rank, he types people in our culture in three types: the normal, the neurotic, and the creative type. He says the neurotic is a healthy type moving on to creative type, but the normal is the smooth stone that really doesn't think for him or herself anymore. Christopher Bolas created the term called the normotic. The normotic is exceptionally and excessively normal. So the words of Jesus, the words of Paul, the words of Buddha, all those words about protecting your mind, the psychologists of the day are saying the same thing. Protect your mind. The danger, I think, is this. If any of you have read or heard of Hannah Arendt, who in 1960, when Rudolf Eichmann was being charged with war crimes, he was the gentleman that made sure the trains ran on time, that took people to death camps and concentration camps. And in her study of what was going on in that trial, she makes the statement that she thought she would find some kind of man who was a monster, a man who was really kind of sullen and brutal. And what she came to discover was a normal man. Wasn't remarkable at all. The deeds were monstrous, but he was quite ordinary, commonplace, neither demonic nor monstrous. Her perception was that he was a common man, kind of mediocre at best as far as being a citizen. And the image that I got was this man whistling at work, eating his lunch, while he's making sure the trains run on time as people are entering the trains going to the death camp. To me, being, when I imaginatively put myself in the victim position of the world of zombies, if I were to witness that man eating his lunch as I'm getting onto that train car, I think I'm seeing a zombie. What was remarkable about this man, she said, what was remarkable was that he was entirely thoughtless. He was quite authentic in his inability to think. When confronted with situations for which such routine procedures did not exist, he was helpless. He was ridden with cliches, language that he produced on the stand, and he evidently, that's what he did in his official life. She says it was like a macabre comedy. The cliches, the stock phrases, the adherence to conventional standardized codes of expression and conduct that socially have recognized a function against protecting us from reality. These passwords that he used protect us against reality. And this frightens me, because when I watch the news, what do I see? But cliches, passwords, sound bites. On all sides, sound bites from Reverend Hagee, Parsley, sound bites from Reverend Wright, we see all this. And I'm wondering, am I a cliche, a password, a soundbite? Have I protected my mind? Have I guarded my mind jealously so that it could be free? Have I become someone who makes sure the trains run on time? Have we as a society become that? There's another term, and it's a jargon term, so forgive me. It's called extractive interjection. I call it stealing the bright object, as I do counseling. And this term is used for counselors, but I want to generalize that term to a larger group of people. And essentially what extractive interjection means is that somebody steals my mental content. Somebody steals what goes on in my mind, or somebody shames it, or somebody dismisses it, and they bring in their own ideas, and I begin living their ideas. Now, you might think that sounds kind of weird. But how many of us in relationship have surrendered our truest selves, and then gave way to become what the other person wanted us to become? How many of us have ever done that?
Not right now.
Extractive interjection. How many of us in childhood sacrificed who we truly were meant to be, or our potential, or our dreams and our hopes, because it was more rewarding to do something different? We got strokes to do something different. And so we surrendered ourselves and began to live. I'm suggesting that process of stealing or of diminishing one's mind so that somebody else's thoughts and ideas come in happens on a national level all the time now. Wasn't always that way in our country. That didn't really happen until about 1914. We can put a date on it. And the leaders of our country wanted to enter, business leaders and government leaders, wanted to enter World War I. And our nation at that time leaned toward isolationism, leaned toward pacifism, and did not want to fight. So they created this massive campaign to change the mind of our population. And in 6 months, we were demanding to go to war. In 6 months. The mindset of the nation was extracted. And through the vehicle of propaganda, there was an interjection. After that, the government and business alike were so surprised of how easy it was to do that, rather than recognizing our vulnerability as human beings and honor that, and then protecting us from that, it was used against us. And another example around the same era of time. Workers around 1900, and unions were getting some strength in, I mean, it was a very bloody and serious fight, but the unions were getting some strength. But workers were of the mindset that they would want to get paid more hours and have more leisure time. I kind of like that idea. Except, there was a group of people who got together and said, wait a minute, that's problematic. And as a matter of fact, a department store owner said, you know, if you let those people, me, who'd be symbolic of those people, have too much leisure time, they become radicals. You can't let them have too much leisure time. And there were radicals. Remember the Red Scare and the socialists? I mean, there were people who were demanding rights at that particular time. So there was a campaign to say, we will give you as many working hours as you want. We're not going to give you more per hour, but you can work more. And as a matter of fact, there was an effort to make that it was a high value to buy the commodities, to buy the objects we were making, so that you could work more hours to buy these objects that would delight you and that you would want. And so they created the desire for these objects that people began to buy the idea that I need to work more hours in order to buy these products. The national mindset of workers was completely changed. And I am saying, when we wrestle with that question, to be or not to be an alive, creative human being, right at that moment in time, out of desperation, we either decide to become more than we were and construct our own life and be part of our own creation, no longer having somebody else write our story for us, but we begin to author our own story, or we numb ourselves out somehow. Addictions, living how somebody else wants me to live, sacrificing my life that way. Any number of ways we do that. And we've all, if we're human as far as I can tell, have done it somewhat, somewhere along the way. But I am suggesting at this point in time, our truest voice is needed to deal with the issues of today. It's not okay to be numb. It's not okay to be conformed. It's not okay to make sure the trains are running right. I need to know the purpose of the trains and why they're running, and I need to confront, am I part of a process that's really destructive, and I need to back out of that process and figure out a different way for me in my life? Who am I in this time and this place? Who am I? Just to ask that question moves me away from being conformed to this society. Who am I at this time? As Unitarian Universalists, sometimes we struggle with a heartfelt commitment to our values that pulls us through the difficult times. And I'm saying today that a heartfelt commitment is absolutely needed to a set of principles, to a values, to help us maintain our truest selves, to guard our minds against the persuasive propaganda, sound bites, cliches that many in our nation have structured their personality with. That we, being committed to values that encourage process, that encourage meaning-making and reflection, if we exercise those values, we will not be trapped into that conformity. However, we will be called to responsibility to fulfill our calling as a religious people. Let us guard our minds jealously. Let us protect ourselves as individuals. And let us help one another in this community guard each other's minds so that we can be who we need to become in this time and place.